Hi Colin, how are you doing? Good to have you on again.
Brilliant, brilliant to be back, finally.
And for the listeners who are maybe a little bit confused right now, this isn't me doing some kind of like VO intro. We have a new format. Is this the end of the Coder career? Absolutely not. It's really just the start. So this is a new format that we're bringing on as part of the Coder Career podcast, where me and Colin, who you may remember from a very successful episode a few episodes back, we're basically going to be talking about what really is a certain technology, because Colin is a lot more experienced than me. So it's really amazing to have someone with that kind of experience to come on to explain these concepts to people who, you know, are in that sort of 0 to 5 years of experience or even further along than that. So I'm really excited that we're working together. And it's not just in terms of the podcast, actually, in terms of the organization, the Coder Career and everything we're building around that, I'm absolutely delighted and really excited to say that Colin is going to be joining up. So yeah, great to have you here both on the pod, and great to have you as part of the Coder Career journey.
So chuffed to finally be here. I was really excited when we spoke about like the Coder Career when we first met, and yeah, I'm just really, really pumped to like help you out and get going with this stuff. And I think there's just a really good opportunity just now in the market for people that have like came through boot camps and have like self-taught, or you know, are learning their coding career. You know, like exactly what you said with the Coder Career is this community around people that have 0 to 3 years experience. And that just completely vibes with me, because I really want to help people at that level, and hopefully I can put my skills to use there. And I'm just really excited to co-host the podcast with you, Cameron. So thanks very much, buddy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think if we're able to capitalize on half the ideas we had when we were six beers deep at a Mexican restaurant a few weeks ago, then I think I think things would go very well.
Yeah, no, they had some good ideas and the ideas keep flowing. So yeah, no, let's do this.
Good stuff. Right, cool. Well, so today's episode, and I suppose really I'll let you more or less take the lead on this, because this is kind of your format going forward. We're going to be talking about what really is an application and what is OSS. Mm-hmm. So really, I mean, everyone's got a basic idea of what an application is. I assume so, because you fired up your podcast player here. So I would assume everyone knows, even if you've never written a line of code, you probably have a decent idea what an app or an application is. Why are we going to talk about this today, Colin? Don't you think this is a little bit basic? Like, this isn't the learn how to use technology podcast. This is the learn to code and get a job podcast.
No, that's actually a really good point. I like the way you phrased that as well. No, you're right. Like, I think I was teaching coding at CodeClan for 3 years. And before that, I was kind of getting into teaching code and learning how to code. And like I say to a lot of people, I describe myself as being somebody who's quite slow at learning. But the advantage there is that I can explain things really well. And I've managed to practice that. And one of the things I realized in that time teaching and, you know, doing a lot of learning myself, is that having a really, really fundamental understanding of some concepts like what really is the application and what is it that I'm, when I'm building something, what is it that I'm really building? Like, for example, right, if I was to write an application that does podcasting software, you know, it's just the first thing that came to mind, do I have to write the code that like transfers the data between my computer and your computer? Or, like, is there something that I can use that helps me with that? You know, where is the boundary between what you write as part of the thing that does the job that you're there to do, which is the application, and what's the difference between that and other parts of the code? You know, how much do you really have to write, and how do you know where that boundary is? And basically, what we want to talk about today is making sure that the people that are listening to this, even though they might be some of the listeners are definitely going to be people that have like hopefully between 0 and 3 years experience, there's definitely going to be something in this episode for people who are in that category. And the reason that that's important is because, you know, you've got to understand, if it's not application code, then it must be library code or tooling code. and being able to know the difference between all those three things is really important. And finally, we also just want to have a quick chat about open source as well, and open source is extremely important to how all that fits together. So we'll start off really basic, and we'll hopefully go quite deep on some really good fundamentals.
Absolutely, I'm excited. And yeah, whether you literally learned code last week, or whether you are one of the OGs of the industry, then you'll definitely get some value out of today's episode, I'm sure. So yeah, I mean, like you said, start off super basic, straight up. I mean, you've named off a few different types of code there, so to speak. Yeah. What's the difference? App code, library code, like, is it not all the same?
Yeah, it's a good question. That's a good place to start off the discussion in this episode. So basically, an application does something for someone or thing, and the thing part is quite important. And it's that application is concerned with a particular domain. And that's maybe a word that we're going to use quite a lot. And what we mean by domain is what problem are we solving? And generally, that application should solve a problem in that domain. And that's like the introductory, like, what is. Library code is code that an application or developer will use to help them solve that problem in that domain. And that means by, you know, by definition, I suppose, or by assumption, that the application code is domain specific, it solves a particular problem. And the library code, or the tooling code we're going to talk about as well, is generic, basically. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. I think maybe something that may trip people up here is there's a few different definitions of library code almost. You have things like UI libraries, then there's like package managers like npm and pip that you can install things from. Is there much of a difference there, or is kind of everything under that umbrella library code?
That's a good question. So some of that stuff, most of the stuff that you'll install if you do like npm install my whatever, a lot of it will be library code. Some of that stuff will be what we call developer tooling as well. And that we'll talk about that later on a little bit as well. But that's basically a type of library code, but it's not designed to be shipped with the application. And we'll talk about what that means as well. But it is designed to make the developer experience like a lot better, to make it so that, for example, it becomes easier for me to build my application. But that code that you're talking about doesn't always actually get shipped with the application. And we've got a few examples of that. Like, for example, if you install a library to like write tests, that library that you install to help write your tests, that doesn't get shipped with your application, but it is a developer tool that is usually open source and usually has to be installed through like something like pip, as you said, or npm or yarn or whatever it is that you're using.
So that's brilliant. So really, if I'm an aspiring developer, I can just look up the NPM registry, just find all the packages I need, and just bolt this code together, right? I barely even need to write any code. Surely there's no disadvantages there.
that's actually spot on. And that's kind of one of the reasons that I wanted to do this episode, actually, because I think I sort of feel like when we are beginner developers, when we're teaching beginner developers, we discover this NPM registry, we discover GitHub, you discover pip, you discover Maven if you're using Java, you know, Gradle, Cargo if you're using Rust. Like each of the big techs that people tend to use have this concept of a package manager. And I think I sort of feel that when people come across that, they go a bit mad. It's almost like I've got a hammer and everything turns into a nail. And now I just want to npm install everything. I want to use all these libraries, and it's a great journey of discovery. But one of the reasons I want to talk about this on this episode is because I want people to have an appreciation of what it is they're actually installing, and have a think about where that boundary is between their application and the thing that they're building. And there's some really, really interesting things we can talk about as part of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's always worth considering as well that library code that you install via a package manager, it's served from elsewhere and it can change. I mean, do you remember the Faker.js debacle, for example?
Yeah, no, that's it. That's a lot of, there's a lot of weird stuff that can go on there. So, like, I've seen so many people just install something and not really pay much attention as to what they're installing. So hopefully we can give a bit of you know, underneath guidance on how to think about stuff like that.
In fact, actually, a word of caution/warning, and this story is quite funny, but I heard about this at a security meetup, actually, and it really stuck with me, about installing random NPM packages. One of the lead web developers on Donald Trump's campaign, they realized that they were using a group that realized that they were producing a library that Donald Trump's campaign were using in their website, and they politically disagreed with him. And so this was during the 2016 election run-up, and they actually reconfigured their package to essentially redirect the user to Hillary Clinton's campaign page. So always remember that as funny as that is, always remember that you're never in charge of your of the code, for sure. So that's definitely something people should consider, isn't it?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I like that. I hadn't heard that story. That's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, it's I very much enjoyed it when it happened, I've got to say. So is it not just like the app is the UI and then the library is underneath? Is it that simple, or does it go a bit more deep than that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So let's take an example of like a native application. Let's say we're building something like a budgeting app. We've got code that deals with like the logic for the budgets. We've got a create views for the user interface. And if there's a backend code that speaks to the database or other infrastructure, that's all application code. The library code is the stuff that's used by the developer to do stuff like render stuff to the screen, render stuff to the UI, read and write to databases, make requests over the internet, and call out to APIs. So if you think about it, every app you build is going to probably have some form of database at some point. It's going to want to do stuff over the web. It's going to want to make HTTP requests. It's going to want to render stuff to the screen. It's going to want to like put buttons up there, put input fields up there. And what we're really saying is that library code is stuff that lets you do stuff like that. I mean, that's a very basic example. You can get library code for all different types of applications, but library code is the part that lets you do stuff like that. But it's generic enough in a way that you don't install it, and it is the same for every application that you look at. Now, I know what you're going to say. There's some exceptions to that, you know. If you've ever heard of things like Bootstrap or any of these like UI libraries, they are a bit different in that they're designed to give you something that's opinionated and something that looks a particular way, but maybe has some options for like, you know, modification. But that's not the point. Generally, the point is that the library code is something that's generic enough to not be specific enough for your needs only. That wouldn't make sense. You know, it wouldn't be very reusable if it was just for your for your code only. That makes sense.
it does, but here's my question, right? So when I'm writing code for my full stack web application, I'm making database calls. I'm like calling the APIs. I'm firing all this stuff up and down the stack. I'm looking at the network tab, my browser. I'm writing the code to make these calls, and it renders in the UI, right? So surely I'm the one controlling all this, or am I desperately wrong here? Have I been a stooge by asking this question?
Yeah. I know you're playing the devil's advocate a little bit by asking that question, so thanks very much for that. I guess the point is this: when you write an application, you do need to deal with those things as a developer, right? I don't want anyone who's thinking about becoming a dev or somebody who's on their coding journey or at the beginning of their coder journey, or even if you are an engineer and you're at your first job and you're still picking up a lot of things, which obviously you will be for a good while, and even when you're 15 years in, trust me, you'll still be picking things up. But when you write such an application, you do need to deal with those things. But you do not write the code that actually takes the data and renders it to the screen, or takes the data, for example, breaks it down into buffers and sends it over HTTP calls to be accessed over a network socket. And the thing I want to make sure is eliminated to people that are in all parts, like in all of their beginner stages of their careers, is that there's so much going on under the hood when you use a library, when you use another dependency, another piece of code that's not been written by you. You know, there's so much it can seem like magic, you know, happening under the seat, under the hood there that you're not aware of. And in other words, like the application developer uses these things that someone else has written to make it easier to do so that we don't need to deal with the low-level tasks, you know, and we can use the code that's been written and used a million times before, and it's been proven to work, and it's been proven to like to do a good job of that thing. You know, like take an example at the start of the podcast there, where I said, if we're going to build a podcasting app that does like, you know, over internet recording, do I want to write the code that like takes the audio and then records that into like a buffer, an audio buffer, and then like takes that chunk by chunk and sends it across the network? Or do I want to use a library that's going to help me do that, you know, and apply that to every other problem, right? Like you don't, you know, in some cases you might want to do that, but generally you don't. I guess we need to talk about like this idea as well of low level and high level. So I mentioned there a minute ago that we don't need to deal with some of the lower level tasks a million times before, you know. So low level is an important word to understand if you're fairly new to all this stuff, and as is high level. And I remember meeting some people that thought that like high level was like that there was something to do with the complexity, and I suppose there is, but basically like it's a relative term to describe how close to the raw machine code or the bits and bytes of the system when we're writing code. So I know that you know this, but like just for the benefit of the listeners, when we deal with like bits and bytes, that's us dealing with low-level code. And as I say, it's a relative term. So for example, when we write code, the coding language that we use is written on top of a machine code level. And that's for a reason. That's so that we don't need to deal with machine code. Humans aren't good at machine code. We'll probably do a bit more chat about this in other podcasts, hopefully, but we don't want to have to deal with like, you know, really horrible numbers and instructions like MOV and to move data from one register to another, or add data in two registers, which is actually quite straightforward, but
yeah, we certainly don't want to deal with that. Yeah, it's like if I'm a bricklayer, do I really want to sit and make each individual brick time, or am I going to get my supplier to send me some bricks? Like, I know what my boss would want, and I know what I would want, because I don't want to spend my time making bricks when I know my expertise is making sure the wall is constructed and it doesn't fall over. That is what I'm trying to do, right? It's specialization. Like, it's the basis of labor economics, really. Specialization applied to technology. It's quite interesting. And I mean, obviously it's a very important concept to understand. I mean, if we talk about abstraction, what would you say that is, and why is it an important concept for software engineers?
Abstraction is just so important for software engineers because it's at the core of everything that we do ultimately, right? It's at the core of being able to take things and make them simpler. So, for example, right, you don't need to do this, but you wouldn't typically go to build like our podcasting application or like a money management application by writing a whole bunch of Rust code or C++ code or C code. If, for example, you set out to build a web app, and you also probably wouldn't do that if you wouldn't, as I said before, you wouldn't build the the code that handles like the data transfer between your voice and the microphone and accept the data over the wire and decode it into the file format. You want to use something that does that for you. And then what you'll typically do is you'll use something that makes that even easier again. And there'll be layers on top of all of those things going up and up and up and up to the point where you're just using a simple method or function that someone's written for you, which says record audio. And then you call that, but actually under the hood, what's happening is it's making a call down to what we call a system library. And then the system libraries happen somewhere in the operating system. And that call then calls down to something that's maybe written in an even lower level language that you don't see, you don't even know exists. It maybe makes some instruction calls out to a particular chip, the audio chip, the audio driver. It interfaces with the audio driver on the computer. And that's all happening under the scenes. And abstraction is extremely important because if abstraction didn't exist, then you as an engineer would be exposed to all of the intricacies and weird complexities and binary blobs and bits and bytes and streams, and you'd have to then map that to memory and
what an utterly terrifying thought. Like,
I know, it's actually
terrifying. You know what? I'm gonna build my to-do list in machine code. That's my plan.
Yeah. We could build that. But as I say, connecting stuff over sockets, going all the way down there is just really tough, The point here is though, all of this is done for us. All of the code that handles all of the things from the really, really low level, which is the bits and bytes, to the higher level library code, it's designed for one user. Okay, and this is one of the takeaways I want listener to have today, is that we've got library code that we can use there, but you need to think about who the user of that library code is. And actually, the user of the library code, and some people think there isn't a user, the user of the library code is you, the engineer, the developer. They're not end users. They're not people that are clicking on buttons and filling out forms or they're not playing video games. They're not like that. They're people. They are users. And this has become very important in recent years, because developers can now consume products to a similar level that consumers consume products. There's developer specific products and developer tools, and all of that is what we describe as library code. So it's
there's a whole world of dev relations, which is yet another really cool career path that you can go down, and that's a whole episode in of itself. And if people want to check one out, we had Scott Spence on the podcast a few months ago now, actually, and he works in dev relations. But that's because it's so important, because because developers are users just as much as end clients are. If you're running a big library, for sure.
I love that you brought that up there just now, mm-hmm. about the dev rel. That's something that I often forget about, and the dev rel stuff is really important, because it shows you that, like, for example, there are so many libraries and there are so many things for you to understand as a developer, to the point of almost like, as an engineer, you're gonna have to at some point in your career make a decision whether you use MongoDB or you use DynamoDB. And this is something I had to decide recently.
Yeah, this is something very close to home, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. We had to do that recently for the coder career. And somebody's responsible in a weird way, helping you make your decision. And I know that sounds like a crazy thing, but there are people in companies who are often, as we'll talk about later on, perhaps, companies that have open source software, or they have even closed source software that they're relying on being able to sell and get, developers to use, even for free. It doesn't even have to be paid for software. that makes sense.
So would you say it's correct to say that library code doesn't have a user? Like the user of the library is of the code is you, the developer? Like how does that all work?
Yeah.
That's a little bit confusing.
That's basically it, right? That's they're 100%. The user of the library code is you, the developer, the engineer, the person who's person uses that library code is you. Now you're 100% right on that. So we can now generalize that there are two kinds of developers from that, right? That there's developers that focus on application work, you know, application engineers, and there's developers who build, you know, tools and libraries for other developers. And of course, don't get me wrong, there are still developers who do both. There's developers who make applications for end users to use and that solve a domain problem. But there are also developers who do both and work on libraries. Like for what it's worth, it's worth saying at this stage, library developers is a sort of generic term that and you won't hear you won't hear of jobs saying like looking for a library developer. You'll see jobs that are a bit more specific to the technical niche that library is required for. So you might see jobs like compiler developer or device driver developer, but we're really just using that term for the purposes of explaining to help our their dear listener understand, like, you know, the difference between the application side and the library side to get it in their head. And application developers is fairly generic as well. You'll probably see like few to no jobs, you know, with that name, but it's fair to assume though that most development or software engineer jobs will be application developers. And this is a really important point that I want people to take away. You need to be aware of the stuff that goes on underneath your application and be able to know how to use it and import the correct library. But you also need to be aware that there's an engineer somewhere being paid to build the library that you are using. And in some cases, as we'll chat about in a wee while, in some cases they're not being paid at all. They're doing it free open source. And but yeah, library developer jobs are significantly smaller percentage of all of the engineering roles, you know, because it's a very niche thing, but it's definitely worth knowing about. I actually used to be a library developer. I was a compiler engineer. The compiler is a tool that we use to convert code to like a lower level machine code that the chip can use. But we'll probably hopefully maybe do an episode on that sort of stuff to try and demystify some of that.
I think the listeners will literally hear it flying over my head.
give yourself more credit.
That entire episode. So that should be interesting.
I think between us, we can maybe make a good job of breaking it down though. Like, yeah.
Well, I'll literally be a complete beginner, so I think it will make for a good episode. So everyone will be in the same boat as me, but I'm excited to hear more about that for sure.
It's interesting stuff.
It's interesting to hear about what everything compiles down to. It's easy to fall into trap of thinking, oh, wow, JavaScript is magic. There's logic to that magic. So just to recap a bit, obviously, application developers are using the tools made by library developers. Going to hit you with a comp sci concept here, recursion. Do library developers use other developers' libraries that they make?
I get what you're saying. Yeah,
it's
of course.
Egg,
yeah,
right?
we've been making a very conscious effort to talk about the differences for the purpose of our explanation and understanding. But yeah, it would be weird if you were a library developer who didn't use libraries. Like, let's not pretend. We're not trying to tell you that. If you are somebody who made a library or made something that someone else can npm install, that when you go to do that, you're not allowed to install another library to help you with the thing that you're doing. Absolutely, like there are libraries that and developer tools that are aimed at application developers, and there are even things like which we've not mentioned yet, like things like SDKs, there are source developer kits. Which are like essentially like libraries on steroids that are like whole, like lots and lots of libraries all bundled into one to help people build stuff like iOS apps and Android apps.
Let's not forget the biggest dog of the libraries. React is technically not a framework. It's technically just a JavaScript library, isn't it?
Oh my God. I'm so impressed that you said that. Yes. Yes. Oh, man, you've made me so happy. That's actually
what can I say? I'm not just a pretty face.
That's spot on. But the thing is, right, most people you speak to, like, that are, like even, like, really experienced engineers are like, yeah, I'm going to install this framework, React. And you're like, it's not a framework. Anyway, I'll get off my horse.
Well, this is what I always talk about with, like, how web dev is the most pedantic industry in the world. But I love it at the same time. I love being pedantic and, like, catch people out on the framework and library differences and that sort of thing.
It's not just web dev, I promise you. In fact, web dev's probably not even that bad for it. But yeah, like, to back on your point, like, there are libraries and developer tools that are aimed at other developers. And there are, of course, some that don't make any distinction, you know, like, you can, you know, like, the other day I was wanting to generate some UUIDs. I was trying to generate a unique ID. You know, it's a library that you can install. You use it, you call a method that it gives you, and it gives you back a random unique ID. You know, the point I'm making, though, is you don't have to be somebody who's building an app to use that, or you don't have to be somebody that's primarily building another library to use that. You can be whoever you want. They just serve their purpose, and whoever wants to use them can use them from whatever they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what is the difference between a developer tool and a library, really?
Yeah, great question. A library is, as we've described, we've kind of kicked the tires on that pretty hard at this point. It's something that's used by a developer to help them achieve something as part of their application. Generally, that's a generic thing. That's a generic task that they're going to be doing. That's something that's not specific to their application. A developer tool, though, and we kind of hit on this a little bit earlier on, is simply another application, which kind of comes under that same category of libraries, though, confusingly, that's used by a developer to help them achieve something that's kind of meta, in a way, to the building of their application. Okay, that may be confusing, so better with an example. Okay, so let's say a library is an example of library. We've got React. Stick with the JS theme, since we started with that. You've got React. You've got Redux. You've got Express. These are all libraries, you know. And a dev tool, though, on the JS side would be Webpack. And for people that aren't aware, Webpack is basically a tool that allows you to take multiple JavaScript files and bundle them together so that when they run as one file. But that's something that's a developer tool. It's an application. This is getting confusing. It's an application, but it's not an application that has, like, an end user kind of using it. It's an application that's going to be run by an engineer as part of their tooling workflow. And you'll hear quite a lot about, like, this idea of tooling. Other examples for other languages, you've got Gradle is a thing we use in Java to, like, help us compile Java. And you've got JavaC, JavaC, it's the compiler itself, it's a developer tool. You could even say, like, Node.js is a developer tool, you know. It comes under the category of the umbrella of library/dev tool, right? In other words, when you're a coder, when you're building software, you don't write Node, you write using Node, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think I remember speaking to some junior engineers a while back, and they were like, yeah, but I don't know Node. It's like, yeah, you do. You've been using it for 14 weeks. Like, oh,
it's the hardest thing to explain to recruiters, you know?
Yeah.
Like, everyone who knows JavaScript knows Node, like, these days. Like, that's how it works. Like, but I mean, it's not their fault. It's just the training that they're given. But yeah, it's one of those funny things. And, like, the fact that TypeScript isn't a whole new language, probably, again, something worth having an episode on one day. God, we're generating episodes already in talking recursion. Anyway, so people might be feeling a little bit lost by all of this. I hope not, but just in case they are, do you have any, like, practical examples that you can think of that would help people understand the difference?
Yeah, that's a good idea. So let's say we're building a budgeting app. We might have, like, a lot. We might design that in such a way that we've got, like, you know, like, a login screen. You log in, you log out. You've got a dashboard. You know, you see whatever's happening on the dashboard. Let's just assume it's like a web app for purposes of easy explanation. And you might have something to connect your bank account. You might have something to, like, view your in and out money and all the code, right? This is important. All the code for all of those pages, the HTML, the CSS, the JavaScript, the components, whatever it is that you're using, and all the code that calls out to the backend API, if you've got one, and all of the stuff that handles you bring in a request, you deal with a request, you make a DB call, all of that is application code, right? So application code, like, this is the TLDR of the entire episode. Application code is everything you write. Maybe I should have just said that from the start, but it's maybe worth going in deep. So to build that, we might use React for the UI, which is a library, as you've very correctly pointed out. We might manage that state with Redux or another library. Our backend might use MongoDB, and we might install the MongoDB client, for example, to like help us deal with that. And those are all libraries. And we might we'll use things like Jest to write our test, which is a developer tool. As I said before, the interesting thing about Jest and when you have testing is that they don't get shipped with your library at all. They stay local. They don't actually get shipped. And also confusingly, we'll say I want to install these new dependencies, and just to want to make people aware that when we talk about dependencies, we're just talking about libraries. It's just another way of saying saying libraries. Yeah.
Yeah, I personally prefer the word dependencies. Again, we're talking pedantic here. I personally prefer the word dependencies when I'm talking about it, because it's a good way to think about how your application actually runs. And I'm very much the viewpoint where if you don't have to use the dependency, don't use it, because a dependency almost sounds a bit, it almost sounds like it's a bit of a, it's dragging your app down a little bit, which it is. Yeah. Probably not too significantly, and a lot of time you don't need to sweat about it, but you shouldn't fall into a trap of, like you said earlier, just gluing together loads of dependencies or libraries, because as well as, especially as a junior, like, you're not going to learn if you do that anyway.
That's a really, really good point. Like, I've seen people do that loads. As I say, it might be, like I said, sort of the episode there, we sort of say, when you've got a hammer, everything's a nail, I want to npm install 11 daylights out of the entire world. And yeah, you want to try and be careful about how you do that. Definitely. Yeah.
Side note there, do you know how terrifying it is the number of downloads the npm package for is this number odd or even has? It is
odd or even up package.
The odd, it gets like 100,000 downloads a week.
When we taught npm at CodeClan, this is a bit of a like a sidetrack, but when we taught npm at CodeClan, we taught it we were like, okay, this is npm, and we'd explain dependencies and all the rest of it, and we taught it with them. We would get them to npm install a library called five, which just printed out the number five in a bazillion different ways. And see, now that I think about it, it's just the dumbest way of explaining it. We could do a lot better.
It's a good way of thinking of it, though. Like, if you just bring it down in such a simple way and you don't think about it, like, because it's definitely worth, once your feet are under the table a little bit more and you're feeling a bit more confident, have a dig through some dependency code. And, like, that definitely took away a bit of mystery for me, for sure, when I started doing that a little bit. And that's how I think I started feeling less like a junior once I started, like, messing about with the dependency code and seeing what was going on under the hood a little bit.
That's actually a million percent good advice. Like, because I think it's really easy to fall into that trap of thinking that everything, every dependency, every library, every tool that you use is like some sort of weird black magic that you're not meant to know. Like, I think people assume that you're not meant to know what's going on, and sometimes you use stuff in the documentation so bad that you have to look through it. But yeah, it can be really interesting for smaller projects. You learn a lot to to do that. Good advice.
Mm-hmm. And the elephant in the room will be APIs, really. Like, are APIs seen as libraries? How does that work? Because they're in that ecosystem, but they don't really fit into anything yet. Are they just their own thing?
Really, really good question. So just as a quick reminder for us on what APIs are. So APIs are, the API stands for Application Programmer Interface. And I'm going to get a little bit like, well, actually, like, you know, a little bit computer nerd, like, well, actually, it's technically, and I'm sorry for this, so I apologize up front. So I'm going to say, well, actually, technically, when we use a library, we're actually calling an API. So this is the confusing part. I don't want to have people too bamboozled by this, but when you use any library and you like call the functions of it or you use it in any way, you're technically using an API. But what sort of happened with APIs is more conventionally and colloquially, when someone has an API, that means that they've got a way of getting and modifying data within their application that other developers can use over the internet, which I think if you've never heard of that concept, it sounds mental. Mm-hmm. But one way I used to teach a lot about APIs, and one way I'd explain to it is that if you're an internet user, you go to a website and you interface with that website and you click the buttons and stuff, right? But if you're another computer and you want to do something on the internet, you don't go to a website. Programs don't use websites. Programs use what websites run on top of, which is APIs. And a lot of like businesses and, you know, people that are in tech and kind of businessy people in tech get really like obsessed with the idea of APIs because they're super powerful. And all it is this idea that you write some code which connects into a remote server, usually over HTTP, gets some data, maybe sets some data and does like a data exchange. And it's a way primarily of you remotely controlling another system from your application, or remotely getting data from another system from your application, or remotely setting data in another application, you know. And it's basically, APIs make the world go round, right? Like you couldn't pay your bills without APIs. Like these days you can't even unlock your car without an API. You know, so yeah, like that's what APIs are. And the confusing thing, as I said before, is that weirdly, when you call any library, you're using its API. But as I said, colloquially, people really refer to that as being, they really by default mean an HTTP API rather than just a generic API. So as an example, if I want to take payments on my website, I'd use a Stripe API. Let me communicate with the Stripe servers. I've got two choices, right? And this is the interesting point. I can use the API directly. In other words, I can make what we call HTTP calls using like Fetch or Axios or whatever it is the tool or library that you're using to make the call over the internet to get the data. Or I could install Stripe's library. And this is the interesting part. I realize how that may be a little bit confusing, but you can either do the fetch manually to get the data, or you can install the library, which will give you a bunch of functions that you can use as if it were running locally. But actually what it does is it runs and then makes the fetch for you. But it does it in a way that you don't have to make the fetch yourself. And that's us now kind of like coming towards that boundary of between what's the difference between a library and an API. And to answer that question more firmly on the head, a library is something that runs and gives you functions, and an API is something that runs and gives you functions. But in most cases, the API is happening remotely, but the library is happening locally. But they all come under the category of libraries. Oh my God, I think I said the word library too many times.
I think me too. And I'm afraid I've got one more question about libraries for our sins. So where does library code go or like live? When our application runs, like in production, like how does that work? Again, is it magic?
Yeah, of course it's magic. We used to talk about magic quite a lot when I was, you know, teaching and things like that. And I think at first, when I first got into teaching, I was really keen on like the idea of being like, okay, I want you, when I'm teaching you, to just focus on this problem. Therefore, I'm going to explain the rest as magic so that you don't, to try and get you to not focus on it. But it's actually the wrong thing to do. It's not a good teaching strategy. But anyway, we'll talk about that another day. Where does the library code go when our application runs? It depends on the language, okay? So back to the JS example. We use a developer tool, I think we mentioned it earlier on, called Webpack, to take our application code and to take our library code and bundle it together as part of the build process. So what that means is when you like back to our idea of building a money tracking app or a budgeting app, when we built our budgeting app, to get it to go out there into the wild to run on people's browsers to do something, what we'll do is we'll use Webpack if we're using JS, and then that'll take all the library code and it'll bundle it, it'll stick it with the application code. So the application code and the library code get glued together in one big massive file. And a lot of other stuff happens to that. It gets obfuscated and all this other stuff that happens to it. It gets optimized and it gets made, it gets obfuscated for the purposes of security. Which, you know, again, that's another podcast.
That's a whole series of podcasts.
Yeah. So stay tuned, folks. We've got plenty of good content coming up. So if you have a Java application, for example, and you're doing some database stuff, all the database stuff is compiled into the jar file that you run. Python can be either. Python can be bundled in one big bundle, or it can be compiled into separate libraries that are linked together. And again, this idea of linking means that the library doesn't actually live on your system. If anyone's ever been playing an old school PC game and it comes up an error, .dll could not be found. DLL stands for, do you know what it stands for? Pop quiz question.
I know it's a licensing file extension, but I'm not sure exactly what it is. I'm not going to say why I know a lot about DLLs, because I'm not going to incriminate myself.
Because you played a lot of computer games in the late noughties, in the early late 90s and early noughties, and they broke a lot. Nah, DLL stands for dynamically linked library. So what that means is, and I'm trying not to get too boring, but that's a library that exists already on your computer, right? So, like, it's quite common in Windows builds that some of the libraries and dependencies are shipped with the product. So if you download a game on Steam, like, some of the DLLs will be there, like, on that download. I nearly said disk. Can you believe that? A good chunk of them will not be on that disk. In that download, and they'll be actually on the system. And that means that it's not bundled as part of the library of the dependencies, not bundled in some cases. And that's the same in Linux as well. So in Linux, in certain libraries that we get, we might actually link them rather than bundling them or packaging them. And those are called shared object files. But yeah, so it's different. It's different for each different type of application, is the point.
Mm-hmm. So I've got a question, and perhaps this is the business grad of me coming out here.
All right, cool.
But people obviously spend a lot of time writing this library code in DevTools. Do they do it for the money, the fame, love of the game? Why would you do it?
Why do they do it?
And who are they? Like, are they just like random do-gooders, or how does it work?
Okay, applications that are built in different languages are all built with different levels of developer experiences. That means that some languages make it really easy to deal and handle certain tasks, and they make it really easy to like use certain libraries than others. We probably don't want to build our budgeting web application entirely in Rust. We could, but even though it's possible, we could, as an exercise perhaps, to learn Rust. But the point is, being able to understand what libraries and developer tools that are available for a language is the most important skill behind selecting a library or a tool that's going to help you solve your domain-specific problem. That's why a very solid understanding of the topology of your entire tech stack is really, really important. And it's why we're making such a big deal about it. And this is something that I found that even some very experienced developers haven't yet mastered, you know. Knowing where your application ends and your library code begins is actually really easy to do. You can look at your code, and if it's JS, we've been talking about JS quite a lot today, so if it's JS, then it's whatever you're importing. But wherever you're importing that, that's your library code. It's fairly easy for anyone who knows how to do some basic coding to know, to be able to look at their code and say, well, I can see now that that is library code that I'm importing here. But I've always found that seeing that in your code and knowing exactly what's happening is a different thing. Let's take testing, right? Testing, it can be really tricky. It's tricky to learn, but it's also really easy to accidentally write tests that test your library. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got a select query, and I'm writing some tests for my select query. What have you really written tests for there? Have you written tests for your library? Have you written tests for the select query? Like, you know, I'm putting some data into state with Redux, and then I'm testing that that data is in state. You're testing Redux. Redux is already tested. You don't have to test it again. But that's a really, 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 really common thing that happens, which is why we're making a really big point about that, like knowing where that boundary is and realizing that you don't need to test somebody else's library code is very, very important. You should be testing the way your application interacts with that. And there might be some cases, if we're going to talk about testing, maybe some cases where you want to mock away or stub away the library so that you're not having to deal with that as part of your testing. And then on the question of who, well, that's a big one. That's a really big one. It's the rather large subject of open source software, or open source for short, which I think we should talk about now. If you've got any more questions, we can just do that.
Yeah, I mean, what is open source software, first and foremost? Yeah.
Well, you know what it is, but let's just talk about it from the point of view there. Okay, I guess it's the movement to produce code free that anyone can download and use. And we'll have all heard of GitHub, and because I sound like an old timer a bit, but like before GitHub, people who wanted to share code in an open source way used to have to host their own Git servers, which is a bit mad. I worked in a place where we hosted our own Git servers.
That's such an alien concept to me as someone that didn't get into the industry until the late 2010s.
We had a thing called SourceForge online that predated GitHub, where you download zip files of source code, and people used to think it was okay. See, looking back, it's horrendous. But your question was really about why. Okay, so I guess it all starts with application developers. Application developers, when they're solving a domain specific problem for their user, they want to continually make it easier for themselves to do that. To build stuff, and what they do is somebody might be doing quite a lot of in an application. They might have quite a lot of database queries. We build an app, we do a lot of database queries. We build an app, we build a game, and we'll make a 3D renderer. We'll build I'm trying to think of something. I can't think of anything. Something that's going to do some menial task that's going to be repeated a lot. What we might do is, rather than just rewriting that a bunch of times, we should put that into, you know, a reusable function or method or class or module within our code. And in some cases, people go, do you know what? This is generic enough for somebody outside of my organization to use it. And I think it sounds mental to people that have never heard of the concept of open source software before. But that's really how it starts. It starts off with people contributing code for free for other people to use. And most open source code is library code or tooling code. It's things like, you know, your Jest. It's things like your Redux. It's things like React. It's It's, I feel bad that we've really just hammered really hard on the JS stuff today. We're not JS biased in this podcast, but we do really love it. I really love it. I think JavaScript's absolutely freaking amazing. I love it to bits, but I just don't want people thinking that we only talk about JavaScript.
Yeah.
One thing that we should definitely talk about, though, sorry for hogging the mic up, mic too much, but we should definitely talk about the Linux kernel. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, I have, yeah. We went into a bit of depth on it with Kieran Cornwall a few episodes back.
And it was Yeah, that's right. So the Linux kernel is just absolutely huge. I checked before we came on the podcast. It's currently got 1 million over 1 million commits to the repository. So the Linux kernel, just for everyone, it's like the core of the Linux operating system. So Linux is an operating system. It's primarily used in devices like servers and like embedded devices of all sizes, big servers, little servers, containers, virtual machines. You can use it on desktop, but only really kind of hardcore Linux users tend to want to use it on desktop. I used to be quite a big Linux desktop user, actually.
I've tried it on desktop, but yeah, it's not for me. I've used it on servers, obviously, but
yeah,
desktop. I decided I was too normy to use it on a desktop, I think.
Yeah, I think I went the same route and, like, you know, really enjoyed it for a while, but I sort of found that it was a bit like whack-a-mole. You'd install Linux on your machine and you could either have working internet or working CD-ROM drive, but not both. Never both.
Yeah, it is just whack-a-mole.
As soon as you install that CD-ROM drive driver, now I sound old school by saying that, then internet stops working. As soon as you install the internet driver, CD-ROM drive stopped working. So, you know, you get your choice. It's probably came along since quite a lot since 2008, you know, 2009 when I last used it. No, I actually last used it in 2013 on desktop. But Linux is absolutely massive, and it has the biggest open source project probably of them all. I think I said that, like, open source projects are primarily libraries. That's true for the most part. There are some applications, user-facing applications that are open source. There's WordPress, there's Blender, LibreOffice. I'm trying to think of any more. There's not as many, but they do exist.
Do you know what, actually, just to interject, Colin, as well, something I wanted to say. We've been talking about contributing to open source code commits. Mm. For people that are really, like, inexperienced and a bit nervous to do that, you don't actually have to contribute to open source. It doesn't have to be code. My first contribution to open source was fixing a spelling mistake on the React Hook Form website. Like, it can happen. Do you know what is really helpful, apparently? I'm a bit useless. I only speak English. If you speak another language and you can translate documentation into another language, that is really helpful, and people love that. So that kind of thing is just great. And if you can get stuck into that, and it's the sort of thing that really makes you stand out as a junior on your CV, if you helped contribute to documentation and that kind of thing, because as well as just showing you care about the ecosystem, secondly, as well, it shows that you know how to properly, like, raise a PR, like, make commits, like, branch off, you know, make forks of a repo. Sounds silly, almost, me explaining it to that level, but, like, a junior being really good at source control is actually so useful on the team, because it prevents catastrophe.
I had never thought of that. That's absolutely brilliant. Like, I never thought that. Yeah, it's a great idea. If you're like, you know, bilingual or whatever, you could just make some really great contributions by translating stuff. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Then you get your stars as well. And then you've got, like, so the kernel's big. Other big ones, there's some really big ones. One that I used to work on was LLVM, low level virtual machine. LLVM's a bit weird in that it's the compiler that's used by nearly everything. It used to be a compiler called GCC that was used by everything. But LLVM is now the compiler that's used by everything, and that's the bit that takes your code and turns it into machine code. So it's kind of mental, actually, but LLVM is in some cases on every mobile phone and iPhone and Android phone in the world. like I think from memory. So that kind of means that if you've contributed to LLVM in some way, that you probably have your code in every device on the planet. And it's not just LLVM. Like Android, the Android operating system is open source. AOSP, the Android open source project. Yeah, that's you can contribute to that. It's, you know, and then the crazy thing is if your dependency, if your library gets used in a big gets installed in another big open source project, then it kind of you know, shoots to fame or whatever, you know, it gets used a lot. So there's a kind of quite a lot going on there.
And there's obviously a relationship between corporations and open source software, and the highs of which are stuff like Facebook really backing React and making that an amazing ecosystem. Lows of which ended up a complicated situation. Ended up with the founder and creator of Linux shouting "NVIDIA you" on stage at a live event, which I can't remember the details, but obviously there's highs and lows there. So can you explain the corporate relationships and how OSS makes money?
Yeah, that's a good point. So, I guess it's just really worth pointing out that like a lot of open source projects, the big ones in particular, are actually backed by profit making companies. There's a reason for that. Basically, if you are a big massive company and you are using a lot of open source stuff, it's in your interest, believe it or not, it helps your organization to open source projects. It sounds mental, but actually a lot of companies are so big, like take Facebook, that it's easier for them to put something out in the public and have it go round the public and then also be used at other points in within Facebook to get, you know, contributions. Contributions are a massive thing in the open source community. That is when someone takes an interest in your tool, your library, and they, you know, download it and they make a change and then they contribute that back. That's the driver of the open source community. And companies want to help with that, you know, and it tends to be that the bigger companies want to do that. So you've got React backed by Facebook, Rust backed by Mozilla, Spring by VMware, used to be Pivotal. And there's so many companies that back them. And by I say back them, what that means is they hire devs to basically they pay them to work on those open source projects, which is a bit crazy. So if you're really keen, as you get more experience as a developer, you discover that you really love some library, you know, you could, you know, feasibly work on that and then get a job to work at like a really big firm. Or even better, as you become more experienced developer, and you work at a place and then you've discovered that you use this library, or it was your decision to use this a particular library, you could end up being the corporate backer of that library. You know, if it's a small company, you could, you know, do more official open source contributions on that library as part of your job. And that'd be a really cool thing to do. I know that there's some companies that let you do like OSS stuff as part of your 10% time. Which is when you spend, you know, 10% of your time on little projects and things related to your work. So yeah, it's open source is good. Needless to say.
Absolutely. And I think this is a really interesting topic, and I think I'm somewhat being forced to bring this podcast towards the end because my kitten is being an absolute madman. I think he wants his dinner.
Totally adorable, though.
Yeah, he's great. It's a shame it's not a video podcast, because the listeners would have been treated to Earl jumping on my head and then jumping on my shoulder and then falling off my back. And yeah, I'm quite pleased myself that I managed to contain my yelp when he scratched my back while trying not to fall off. But anyway, this has been a cat talk aside, this has been a really exciting first episode to record, and I'm just so excited for the amount of topics that we can discuss next. And you know, it's great to as well have a technical aspect to the podcast, as well as our careers talks as well. So, you know, if people want to hear more from us, all our links are in the description. And if you're new, please do stick around for both this and also our careers podcast as well. There's so much going on with Coder Career. And Colin, just once again, I'm so excited that you are coming aboard. Obviously, the news isn't new to us, but it's new to the public. And I'm so excited for what we're building here. And yeah, can't wait for the next one.
Agreed. Join the Discord. We should get a Discord link on the website, I've just realized. And
link on the link tree. That'll be in the description. It'll pop on the website as well.
Brilliant.
And I put up pictures of the cat on Discord sometimes. So that's a member only treat.
There's a motivation for you to join and join our little community and ask questions. And if you've got suggestions for episode topics, particularly on the technical side, be great to hear them. Happy.
Absolutely. And you could even ask them on the show, because we do have a call-in feature now, which is asynchronous, so you can just leave it as a voicemail. But yeah, that would be awesome. But thanks again, Colin, and thank you, dear listener, for tuning in for another episode of The Coder Career. We're now back onto our weekly schedule, which is super exciting. And thanks again for listening, and have a great week.